Hello, Buzzkillers. It's the old professor here. Our episode last week about the Cuban Missile Crisis was so popular that we thought we'd give you an encore presentation of the other Cold War episode we did a few months ago with Professor Greg Barnheisel. Duck and cover. The buzzsaw is coming.
Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Hello, Buzzkillers. It's the professor here. I'm all by myself today. Well, actually, I'm not all by myself. I'm with Professor Greg Barnheisel. We're here in the Buzzkill Bunker because the myth we're going to bust today is what was the actual nature of the Cultural Cold War? What's the Cultural Cold War, you ask? Well, you're about to find out. Hello, Professor. How are you?
I'm great, Professor Buzzkill.
Your new book, Cold War Modernists, Art, Literature, and American Cultural Diplomacy, has just come out from Columbia University Press. It's receiving great reviews. You've written about this subject in other places, in the Chronicle of Higher Education and other journals. How did you get onto the subject in the first place?
Well, I became really interested in the Cultural Cold War in the process of doing some earlier research when I found some people that I'd been writing about, like the American literary publisher, James Laughlin, who had some connections with people that I later discovered were in the CIA. And we can talk about that a little later, but that sent me into doing research about how were people who were involved in really kind of revolutionary experimental modernist art also involved in working for places like the State Department and the CIA. And that led me to do a lot of research on what is the Cultural Cold War? What does that actually mean?
Yeah, what does it mean? Because we all know what the Cold War was, and certainly the Cold War involved a lot of proxy wars in Vietnam and Korea and other places. But what was the Cultural Cold War?
So the Cultural Cold War was the struggle for influence that waged between the Soviet Union and the United States among target populations all over the world. So This would happen in Vietnam. This would happen in Africa. It happened in the Middle East. I'm most interested in how it happened in particularly Western Europe in the 1950s, where we've got the United States is trying to sway these Western European intellectuals to side with the Western side in the Cold War. And the Soviets are trying to sway them to the Soviet side because intellectuals in Europe, unlike in the United States, have a lot of actual influence on culture and politics.
Right. That's very fascinating because a lot of the people you bring up in your book are pretty highbrow thinkers and highbrow artists. It's amazing to me that, and it'll be amazing to a lot of our listeners, that the United States government would spend a lot of time worrying about how that sort of upper sliver of intellectual society would influence the rest of those countries when it doesn't or didn't in the United States, where it's clearly not as much.
Yeah, and particularly President Eisenhower was very interested in this. And one of the first things he did when he came into office was establish a commission. It was called the Jackson Commission, based on the name of the guy who was in charge of it. And their job was to figure out how to influence intellectuals abroad, because they knew that where the intellectuals led, the people would follow. And so if you could get the loyalties of the people in places like France and Italy and Greece and West Germany, then we would have this bulwark against Soviet expansion culturally, because the Soviets were really making some inroads. And people, and as many of your listeners may know, in the 1930s, a lot of people and a lot of intellectuals became communists and joined the Communist Party, and a lot of them stayed there through the 50s. Jean-Paul Sartre is an example of someone who was a staunch communist through the 50s.
So the Eisenhower administration especially thinks this will actually work, right?
Absolutely.
They believe that by influencing cultural intellectuals, influencing artists, it will, if you will, trickle down. I don't mean that to sound snobby, but it'll trickle down to the rest of the population and it'll influence them towards a better impression of American culture and therefore a better impression of the United States.
Exactly. And then more support in this confrontation against the Soviet Union that in the 1950s, we didn't know where it was going to go. It could have gone bad quickly. And there were a couple instances, and Korea is one of them, where there was military action in Europe as well, in places like Hungary and Poland, and we didn't know whether Soviet tanks were going to come rolling across the border or not.
Right. It was cold and it was tense in terms of a war. Well, so what actually happened? What did government agencies actually end up doing?
Well, under the Truman administration, and you may know that the Cold War really starts in 1946 when Winston Churchill, and I know that you have some affection for Winston Churchill on the Professor Buzzkill show.
Immense.
Declared that a Iron Curtain had fallen across Europe in a speech that he gave in Missouri. And Truman's projects were very heavy-handed and very transparently propagandistic. And they worked a little bit through State Department shows, and most famously a traveling painting show that we sent over there. We can talk about a little bit later, but also through Voice of America radio and through printed stuff. But in 1952, when Eisenhower was elected, Eisenhower comes in and he says, we've got to do a better job. We've got to be more sophisticated in how we appeal to intellectuals.
Okay, now Eisenhower is often seen as perhaps the most unsophisticated of American presidents. Of course, Truman wasn't seen as super sophisticated either. But Eisenhower is a golf playing, is a TV watching, is a TV dinner consuming president in a lot of the people's impressions. But it turns out that's really not the case when it comes to the work he actually had to do, right?
No, he really wasn't. And one of the things this project gave me was a much greater appreciation for just how smart and sophisticated Eisenhower was. He really was a golf-playing general. He wasn't particularly intellectual himself, but he knew just how important psychological warfare was and how important it was to get the loyalties of influential intellectuals in a population. And I think he learned about that during the Second World War, but it became extremely important in the Cultural Cold War. And so he hired smart people and brought them into his administration and said, how do we get these intellectuals, many of whom are either communist sympathetic or potentially even members of communist parties in places like Italy, on our side?
That's absolutely fascinating. And the perhaps the most fascinating thing to me is that he alights on, or his advisors alight on, the idea of using modernism as the way to penetrate European intellectual consciousness and show that American modernism is sophisticated and therefore the United States is sophisticated. Tell the Buzzkillers, let's remind the Buzzkillers what modernism is, and then also why did they think this would be the most effective avenue?
So modernism is the name that we give to the forms of art that came around in the late 19th and the early 20th centuries. They came about due to the really cataclysmic changes in technology and in politics that were happening at the time. We can think of people like Pablo Picasso and the dancer Martha Graham and the musicians Igor Stravinsky, Arthur Schoenberg, but also jazz is considered modernist. Modernism is best known probably in literature. So we're talking Ezra Pound, we're talking Virginia Woolf, we're talking James Joyce. What it breaks down to is these artists were coming up with new ways of representing the world. You know, you might think of cubism, or you might think of atonal music, or you might think of stream of consciousness narration in literature. New ways of representing the world that reflect the new ideas about humanity that had come about because of the insights of people like Freud and Nietzsche and Darwin. So this kind of art was not hugely popular in the teens and the 20s when it was being produced, and people thought it was ugly, and people thought it was challenging and revolutionary and even kind of dangerous.
Upsetting and disconcerting in many ways.
Very much so, and it was strongly associated with radical political movements. But intellectuals in Europe loved it, and that's what we use to appeal to them. And we had to say, look, if you like modernism, look what we've got. We've got William Faulkner. We've got the Gershwin brothers. We've got Jackson Pollock. If you want sophisticated art, look at what we got.
That's fascinating, because you would think the Eisenhower administration would be a little bit cold, if you will, on modernism because it had all these radical tinges and wouldn't want to be promoting it to Europeans if they're wanting to change their minds and their attitudes towards the United States. But that's clearly not what's going on.
No, and the problems weren't with the Eisenhower administration. The problems were actually with Congress. When Congress would hear about some of these shows that we had put together or some of these artists that we sent abroad, they threw a fit. And I mentioned earlier a 1947 exhibition of art called Advancing American Art that the Truman administration sent over to Europe. Well, the Europeans really liked it. It came to Prague, and it featured a bunch of abstract expressionist paintings and non-realist paintings. But then the Hearst papers got a hold of it, and they printed a story called "Your Money Bought These Paintings," and they were these kind of grotesque paintings.
And this is the William Randolph Hearst newspaper empire. Owned a number of very, very important and influential newspapers in the country.
And they were very conservative and very, very Fox Newsy of their time. You might think of them as the Fox News of their time. Well, and then people started calling in their congressmen, and Congress got very upset about that. And then somebody told Truman about it, and Truman looked at a painting, and it was a famous painting called Circus Girl Resting by Yasuo Kuniyoshi, who was a Japanese-American painter. It's kind of this fat acrobat woman. And he said, you know, if that's art, I'm a Hottentot, which is an arguably slightly racist thing to say. And then he said, there is no art at all in the modernists, in my opinion. And so they yanked that show, and they really stayed away from modernism until Eisenhower came into office.
Well, so who was involved? You've mentioned a few just briefly, but who was involved in terms of artists, famous writers, famous composers? What famous pieces of work would the Buzzkillers know that were involved in this program, in these various programs, I should say?
Well, the most famous person and the person who took the most active role in these programs was the American writer William Faulkner. And Faulkner, he was an odd choice for that, because if these cultural diplomats wanted to showcase modernism more than anything else, the thing they least wanted to showcase was anything having to do with our racial situation.
Right.
But they trotted Faulkner out anyway, and Faulkner was just a brilliant cultural ambassador. He had won the Nobel Prize in 1950 and gave a very famous speech that melded nicely with some of our rhetoric about freedom and individualism. And then he would go on these junkets and these tours and talk to Japanese audiences and Icelandic audiences and audiences in Italy, and talk to them about how it's American freedoms and really Western freedoms and Western individualism that allows great art to happen. And this was very powerful among these target audiences, not only in Western Europe, but also in places like Latin America, where Faulkner was particularly influential.
Now, this brings up the actual myth that I've wondered about for a long time, because I always thought, and I always learned in college, that these artists responded like Faulkner did. They were given the government money, and they were happy to shill for the government. They were in many ways, they could have been considered stooges for American capitalism, and that as soon as they got the patronage, they were able to become very patriotic and do whatever the CIA or whatever government agency it was told them to do and told them to say about American culture. But this is not the case. In your book, you make the very strong argument that this is not the case.
No, and I think we have to look back at this time not through the lens of, well, all the nasty things the CIA and the American foreign policy have done post-Cold War, but what it looked like then and just how scary Stalinism was. And people had started to realize just how bad it was after this famous secret speech given by Khrushchev. And these people like Faulkner and like, I can talk about Louis Armstrong in a second, who was also one of the people sent abroad. Well, they weren't in love with everything the United States did, but they were absolutely convinced that it was better than anything the Soviet Union had to offer. Well, the reason we get the stooge narrative is that the CIA and the British Information Services set up in 1950 a group called the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which was ostensibly an independent kind of lefty intellectual artist group. And they were very active in Europe through the 50s and 60s, and they published magazines and they set up conferences, and a lot of big names were in it. And it came out through some reporting the New York Times did in 1966 that this thing had been set up by the CIA. And people said, well, all of you people involved in this Congress for Cultural Freedom, you have been stooges. You have been witting participants in a CIA front project. And don't forget, 1966, the CIA's got a terrible reputation because of what's going on in Vietnam. So I would say that some people may have slightly been stoogey, but for the most part, no. Either the people didn't know what was going on, or they really believe that the United States, if it's a confrontation between the United States and the Soviet Union, they'll take the United States every time.
And I think it's important to stress that when we talk about if it's a confrontation between the United States and the Soviet Union, by this time, by the 50s, it's often thought about as a confrontation between the United States and Stalinism. Because an awful lot of the people you talk about early on, their famous writers, Arthur Koestler and on and on and on, are members of the Communist Party, committed communists, and then they turn when things go bad.
Exactly. And this is why it was so important to appeal to these leftist intellectuals, because a lot of them had been communists during the 30s and through the 40s. And then for various reasons, sometimes because they got stuck in the gulag and then got out, or sometimes because of the Hitler-Stalin pact, where we thought that Stalin and the communists would stand up against the Nazis, and then they made a deal with them to divide up Poland between themselves. And sometimes because of anti-Semitism or whatever. These people broke with the communists. These people broke with Stalin. and they became the most avid anti-Stalinists. They were not capitalists by any means. Many of them would consider themselves Trotskyites. Many of them would consider themselves socialists, at least. They were not capitalists, but they, more than anything, they were not Stalinists.
And the Eisenhower administration presumably considers this good enough.
Exactly. Right?
That they can promote this kind of modernism, they can promote these artists because although they may not be purely capitalistic, they will appeal to European intellectuals, and they're the best we've got.
Exactly. And hence the conflict between the conservative strain back at home in the United States, who wanted nothing to do with anybody who had a taint of leftism. So we were talking about, this is the McCarthy era. And then using these leftist, former communists, sometimes still quasi-pinkos, as our cultural diplomats in Europe.
Right. Now, this is the important turning point as we've been talking about. Can you tell us more about how your work in particular has changed this perception that I grew up with, for instance, and or at least as a college student grew up with, that they were stooges? Is there more subtlety to what the artists are doing and the musicians are doing? Are they trying to present a kind of diverse nature of American culture and American modernism? Are they kind of like taking the Eisenhower shilling, but then presenting what they want to present as American culture?
Yeah, and it's important to remember that the Eisenhower administration wasn't commissioning artworks. They were taking existing works and putting them on tour. And
okay, hang on 1 second. That's very important, Buzzkills, because that's something else I didn't know. So that's another myth. Busted.
glad to be busting. So the Eisenhower administration wasn't commissioning pro-American works. What they were doing is putting works that had been produced often in the 30s and 40s on tour and say, look what we have. And a lot of these works were very critical of the United States to begin with. So, I mean, if you want to send over a bunch of novels about how great life is in the United States and how everybody's happy and how capitalism's working, you're not going to send Faulkner novels over.
No, not at all.
Not, no. And you're not going to send Hemingway over, and you're not going to send Fitzgerald over. And these modernists are not, I keep referring to Norman Rockwell, but that's not the portrait of America that they give.
And in fact, Faulkner and Hemingway themselves, in terms of their, shall we say, social proclivities, were perhaps not the best images that the Eisenhower administration wanted to present.
No. But Eisenhower was very willing to send over work that was critical of the United States, partially because that was the message. We support stuff that criticizes us. We can have that kind of diversity of opinion. The Soviets can't. One of the things I talk about in the book is the artistic, I don't know if you'd call it a movement, I would call it more of a mandated style called socialist realism. In the 1930s, Stalin and his cultural commissar, a guy named Zhdanov, said, all Soviet writers and artists have to produce works in this style called socialist realism. It has to appeal to the masses. It has to be simple and transparent, and it has to have the very simple message of building up the Soviet Union and exalting Stalin. So when we would send over things like Porgy and Bess, or we would send over Faulkner, or we also sent over the Dave Brubeck Quartet, or we would send over Martha Graham, and it was challenging art and it was interesting art, and the Soviets would send over, a beautiful painting of a beaming Stalin looking at a collective farm with their new tractor.
Right.
And it was a joke. And European intellectuals had no patience with that kind of stuff.
Right. What were some of the more, can you give us more detail about the different government agencies and how they might have acted? There's, of course, the U.S. Information Agency, as you say, the Voice of America Radio. But I don't think people generally know about the range of agencies involved and the range of sort of efforts to get this cultural Cold War won, if you will.
So I'm not a historian. I'm trained as a literary scholar. And so this is the first time I've worked in government archives. And the first thing that shocked me is, you know, as a young teenage leftist, I was always sure that the government was out to get us and they were this kind of unified force. But what I learned is there's no such thing as the government. There's 50,000 different agencies and offices and people all working at cross purposes and all conflicting with each other and sometimes working together and sometimes not working together. So just within this program, we have the Voice of America, which is a radio and the official voice of the United States government is like very similar to the BBC. But we also have Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, which are not associated with Voice of America, and they're much more propagandistic and they're ostensibly private. We have the State Department, who's sending over diplomats, but who's also sending over Faulkner and people like that. We have the United States Information Agency, which is separate from the State Department. Within the State Department, we have the Art Office, which was created and then really unceremoniously dumped after 3 years. And then we have administration, other kinds of administration offices that are sending over people and that are sending over writers. And they're all working kind of together, but they're also very diverse, and sometimes they were getting in each other's way. We have libraries abroad. We have book translation programs abroad. There are really thousands and thousands of people in Washington who are working on these projects, and so much of the time, the left hand and the right hand didn't know what each other were doing.
So it'd be almost impossible for the Eisenhower administration to craft a single coherent dominating message anyway, because there were too many agencies involved, there were too many different artists involved, right? There couldn't have been a directive, if you will, that would have gotten very far.
Exactly. And you can't tell, you can't tell abstract expressionist painters what to do. You know, they're not going to listen to you.
Right.
One of the stories I tell is of a painter named Jack Levine, who was a Boston painter, and he was what's called a social realist painter, not a socialist realist, but a social realist painter. Uh-huh. And he had a painting that was put on the 1959 exhibition that we had, that we mounted in Moscow, which is most famous because it was the site of the kitchen debate between Khrushchev and Nixon.
That's the famous debate, Buzzkillers, where Nixon and Khrushchev are standing in a model American kitchen in this exhibition and debating the merits of capitalism and kitchen, modern conveniences and modern appliances over the merits of socialist kitchens, if you will, which were much more egalitarian.
And much less high-tech.
But
so this painting that Jack Levine sent over there was a very critical painting of a grotesquely depicted fat American capitalist and a militarist general. And I think the third guy is some sort of a religious figure. And it is a very critical of the United States. And it's basically saying capitalism and militarism go hand in hand. Well, they sent this painting over as part of a pro-American exhibition. And predictably, some conservatives saw that and were furious at Eisenhower. And Eisenhower said, well, you know, it's not really to my taste, but who am I to judge?
That's a fascinating reaction. That's an absolutely fascinating reaction. I never would have guessed that, and I certainly wouldn't have guessed that when I was in college studying this. So you've definitely busted those kinds of myths. What other sorts of ways have you changed interpretations and corrected misconceptions about how the Cultural Cold War has been studied up until now?
Well, I think the most important thing I did in terms of busting myths is to bust the myth that all of these people who were involved in this were literally CIA stooges.
Right.
Starting in the 1970s, there was a bunch of historians, particularly historians of art, who were saying, well, abstract expressionism, of course it was used on behalf of American capitalism because it's contentless. American painting in the 30s was social criticism, was Thomas Hart Benton, was leftist kind of stuff. And so, of course, the United States government wants to promote abstract expressionism. And they went from there to saying that it was a conspiracy, that they just didn't want to promote abstract expressionism. They created it, they funded it as not an artistic movement, but actually as a political movement.
This is what I studied in college. This is the way of the interpretation.
There's a famous book by an art historian named Serge Guilbeault that has just one of my favorite titles ever. It's called How New York Stole the Idea of Modern Art. And but it's very conspiratorial in that way. And then in the late 90s, a British kind of pop historian filmmaker named Francis Stoner Saunders put out a book about the Cultural Cold War. It's called The Cultural Cold War, that basically said that everybody involved was not only a tool of the CIA and a stooge of the CIA, but a knowing stooge of the CIA. And her research was very persuasive to a lot of people. But as I dug into the same sources she was using and then sometimes looked in sources that she wasn't using, things like the Ford Foundation archives, I discovered it is a lot more complicated than that.
Right. And that's one of our most favorite words, Buzzkillers, is complexity, complexity, complexity.
And just because you happen to have some dealings with somebody from CIA, there's a big leap between that and CIA is giving you money to do certain things and you're doing them exactly as you're told.
Right. We want to stress, however, to the CIA that if you want to fund the podcast, please send us money immediately. We will take it and we will almost do exactly what you tell us to do. Now, we've talked a lot about how all the politics of this worked and a lot about how the art worked and a lot about how the literature worked, et cetera, and how the government worked and how it was so complicated. But how does modernism itself look now that you now that we have these new interpretations, these new discoveries that you've made?
So this is what brought me to this work in the first place. Like I said, I'm a literary scholar, and so I was always more interested in modernism than in the governmental aspects of it. My argument is that this Cold War modernism is what I call it, this reframing of this artistic movement that was really once seen as radical and dangerous and anti-American and anti-middle class, especially anti-middle class values. And I think there's no denying that modernist art is very anti-middle class values. It gets reframed by these cultural diplomats, both within the government and then in private agencies. I mentioned the Ford Foundation, and there are several other private agencies, such as the Congress for Cultural Freedom, that were involved in reframing modernism and saying, no, 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 it's not about revolution. It's not about overthrowing all that you hold dear. It's about freedom and individualism. And look, so is the West. So is capitalism. So is, and the term that was thrown around is bourgeois individualism, the idea that people have they're valuable for themselves. They're not just valuable because they're a member of a class or a member of a party or a member of a state, but everybody's valuable for themselves. Everybody should have the freedom to choose what they do in the world, that people's should determine their own destiny rather than that their destiny is simply to be a tool of, as I said, the party or the state. And that is very much the ideology of the Soviet Union, that the individual person is only valuable insofar as they are serving the greater interests of the state or class conflict.
Right. Well, that's fantastic. Buzzkillers, you're going to get a ton out of this book. We can't recommend it highly enough. We're going to put a link to it on our website, Cold War Modernism, Professor Greg Barnheisel, Columbia University Press, published this year. Thank you so much, Professor Barnheisel, and we can hope we can get out of this buzzkill bunker and back into the light of day.
Well, we'll have to finish up that duck and cover drill a little bit later.
Hey there, buzzkillers. It's the old professor again. I've just left the bunker, and I'm heading back to HQ to file my report. Just want to put a quick word in for the website. Go to www.professorbuzzkill.com. That's professorbuzzkill.com. You see all the blog posts, all the news, all the podcasts, all there waiting for you in one handy place. I was so excited and so engrossed talking to Professor Barnheisel, I forgot to say you can get his book that we've been talking about, Cold War Modernists, Art, Literature, and American Cultural Diplomacy, which was published this year at ProfessorBuzzkill.com. In fact, that's the best way to get it. Go to ProfessorBuzzkill.com, scroll down to the Buzzkill bookshelf. You'll see Professor Barnheisel's book there, Cold War Modernists. Click on it. It's a great read, and it's a very illuminating read. I recommend it highly, highly, highly. And by the way, Buzzkillers, while you're there at Amazon, make sure to load up your cart with lots of expensive items that you need. TVs, flat-screen TVs, computers, all kinds of stuff. It can't hurt and will certainly help. Talk to you later.
Capacast.